Thanks, Ashley. My name's Lucy and I'm an addict.
Hi, Lucy.
Hi, everybody. It's so good to be here. And I just want to thank my lovely friend Lee for asking me to be a service. Big love to you today, mate. Yeah, it's wonderful to be here. And I'm going to start off. I've been reading this tiny little paragraph out of the big book every time I've been asked to share during lockdown and on Zoom meetings, because, you know, they're just, you know, that this book is so amazing, and they're always ready for us, aren't they? They've thought of it before we've even got there. And this is pertinent to my recovery as much today as it was when I walked in the door. And it's basically, it's the last paragraph in the foreword to the fourth edition. And it says, while our literature has preserved the integrity of the AA message, sweeping changes in society as a whole are reflected in new customs and practices within the fellowship. Taking advantage of technological advances, for example, AA members with computers can participate in meetings online, sharing with fellow alcoholics across the country or around the world. In any meeting, anywhere, AAs share experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Modem to modem or face to face, AAs speak the language of the heart in all its power and simplicity. And I just think that, you know, in this world of, you know, this lockdown where we've taken everything online, you know, how that paragraph captures, you know, what's going on today. And we're able to be in meetings and carry the message and continue with our recovery, modem to modem. And that's exactly how it was for me when I first came into recovery. And just to let you all in on a little secret, I'm not in Menorca. I'm in beautiful Kent, but Menorca is a really important part of my story, and it's where I grew up and it's where I came into recovery. And so, yeah, for a little while, I used to be Lucy from Menorca, and I guess I always will be. So how did I end up here on a Sunday afternoon wearing my CA UK 25 t-shirt? I'm a cocaine addict, and you know, I really like cocaine. Cocaine does for me what I can't do for myself, quite frankly. And what I realize since coming into recovery is that the reason I love cocaine is because it gets me present in the here and now. So when I take a line of cocaine, I stop worrying about tomorrow, and I don't feel sad about yesterday or last week or last year. I'm happy, and I've stolen this from somebody else. You know, it was one of the first chairs I ever heard, and he said when he took a hit, no matter what it was, he was happy doing what he was doing with the people he was doing it with. And that is my experience of cocaine. I was introduced to cocaine when I was 16 years old. I'd moved to Menorca when I was 12 years old with my family. My parents divorced when I was quite young, and my mum remarried. And with the sort of the new family, we all went off to live in Spain. And I think really what my mum wanted to do was create a new experience for herself, you know, in the 80s, being divorced, you know, second husband, another child from that marriage, two daughters from a previous relationship. I think she just wanted to make it all right. So we all went off to live in a different country, but we were told not to tell anybody that my stepdad wasn't my dad, and that there'd been a divorce, and my brother wasn't my half brother. So we were kind of encouraged and brought up to keep secrets and tell lies, basically. And that was kind of just the tip of the iceberg of the lies and secrecy that was going on in my home. So off we went to Menorca, and you know, back in the 80s, there weren't a whole lot of, you know, foreign families living in Spain yet at that point. So I kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, got bullied, usual stuff. But you know, for this sensitive little soul, I found it tough going, and I started smoking, you know, dope and drinking beer when I was about 12 years old, and that just progressed on to cocaine at the age of 16. I moved back to England at the age of 18. My stepfather bought me a one-way ticket, and I came back to England, and I was instructed to go and get a job in England. And you know, the interesting thing is that my stepfather was kind of old school, and he didn't really believe in educating girls, but yet sent me off to get a job. So I arrived in England, you know, no tools for living, no idea how to budget. I'd never managed, you know, anything before. But what I did do was I did that thing that I see that addicts do a lot of, and that's make things happen. So I got a job in the music industry. I just answered an ad in a local paper looking for a receptionist in a recording studio, and I got the job. And there were all sorts of, you know, big bands coming in there, and it was all kind of cool. I went out one evening with one of the bands, and we were in a restaurant, and, you know, I tried cocaine once before in Menorca when I was 16. But this particular evening, this line of coke that this guy gave me, it was like, you know, like it says in the book, like Bill talks about, you know, I had arrived. And that night for me, I think I spent the next 12 years trying to recapture that night. And I don't think I ever did. But, you know, herein, you know, began my love affair with cocaine that, as I said, lasted for the next 12 years. And, you know, I always share this, you know, my relationship with cocaine took me from the yacht to the squat. And it started out music industry, touring, went to Japan with a band, with a singer I used to work for, toured around Japan a couple of times, did a lot of touring in Europe, Great Britain. And it was all nightclubs. And I affectionately refer to that time as handbag, hair and heels. And it was all kind of going out and dinners out and parties afterwards. And then, do you know what? The music industry job went. I ended up moving in with the dealers that I used to score off in a local nightclub. I ended up moving into Brixton with them. I ended up being given a pouch of gear and a mobile phone, and I would go out with the driver, and I would just be told to drop gear off at different restaurants, nightclubs, hotels and whatnot, because, you know, I'm a bit posh and, you know, I can smart myself up. So no one was going to check for me, you know, when I was walking into these places. So, you know, I was sent out to kind of drop the gear off around, you know, Cheney Walk and whatnot. And in exchange for that, you know, I got looked after and kept in drugs, you know. That soon progressed into me working in a hostess club. Probably you'll do the maths on what happened in there. I made the mistake of moving from one firm in South London to another. Not something you really want to do. I was threatened with violence. And I moved down to Hastings. I was housed in a refuge for women that are victims of domestic violence because of the threat of violence that I'd experienced and the violence I'd experienced. And then I was introduced to smoking crack and heroin while I was in Hastings. And I did that for a little while. And then I woke up one day and I just thought, do you know what the fuck am I doing? And I got on an aeroplane and I went back to Menorca and I reinvented myself. And I went out, first weekend I was back in Menorca, I was about 24, and I bumped into a guy that I used to go to school with who was a drug dealer, so he became my boyfriend. And then I found out who he was buying off, so I dumped him and he became my boyfriend, you know the drill. And, you know, I carried on using cocaine for another 7 years. But of course, because I put the pipe down, you know, I told myself I didn't have a problem. You know, I put crack and heroin down and I went back to snorting cocaine and doing nightclubs. So, you know, that just kept me in denial for another 7 years. I got married during that time. And, you know, there I was back in Menorca. I'd left my husband. I was working a couple of jobs. And I was miserable, quite frankly. We talk about hitting bottom in Cocaine Anonymous. And I don't think I hit bottom. I think I'd been dragging along the bottom for years. When I came into recovery, I was by no means my lowest. I was just done. I'd left my husband. I was working these two jobs. I was selling gear. My phone only rang if people wanted to buy drugs off me. Nobody wanted to hang out with me. I realised I'd put a hole in my nose from the amount of cocaine I'd put up it over the years. And it was just really shit. And you know, the planet sort of all lined up, and I put my hands up to one of the only people that would listen, and I said, I'm in trouble, I need some help. And this person was really supportive, and he said to me, listen, Lucy, you know, I'll support you in trying to find some help. And we had UK television, we had English TV, and I'd seen the adverts on TV for Talk to Frank, and we Googled the number. It wasn't my computer, I didn't have a computer, we used his computer. We Googled Talk to Frank, got the number, and I rang, and it was the Cocaine Anonymous helpline. And it was Saturday the 21st of August in 2005. And we called the helpline, and the guy answering the phone in London in Cocaine Anonymous that day was a guy called Ian W. And he was, you know, he picked up the phone and I said, you know, my name's Lucy, I'm in Menorca. I think I've got a problem with cocaine and I don't know what to do. And, you know, for me, I mean, I didn't realise it at the time, you know, obviously I look back now and it just blows my mind. You know, he said to me, right, he said, my sponsor lives on the island of Mallorca. I'm going to get him to give you a call. And it's kind of like, you know, of all the people answering the phone that day, it's the guy that's got the house on the island next door in Spain, you know. And so Paul gave, his sponsor was a guy called Paul C. And he gave me a ring that the next day, I think. And I can't quite remember who did it or why, but we'd worked out, someone had had a look online, and we'd worked out that there weren't any meetings on the island of Menorca. No fellowship was here, was there. And, but fortunately for me, Paul was doing service at Area and in Boreham Woods, and he'd go to the meetings, and he knew about the online Area of Cocaine Anonymous, which back then consisted of five online meetings. They were email, it was email-based meetings, it was an email forum. And he came back and he said, Lucy, you need to join one of those meetings. That's what you need to do, mate. There's no meetings there. And that's what I did. And I joined Sisters in Sobriety. I think I my sober date, my date of sobriety is the 30th of August 2005. And I joined Sisters in Sobriety a couple of days later. And I wrote in and I, you know, literally wrote an email and I said, you know, Lucy, Menorca, don't know what I'm doing, help. And I just got this outpouring of love, of emails from women from all over the world. And it's the online meetings back then, like I said, were just email based. It wasn't Skype or Zoom wasn't invented. We didn't have WhatsApp. And this meeting was wonderful. They're the biggest cross-talking meetings of Cocaine Anonymous in the world. And there were people from, women from, you know, literally, you know, Europe, America, whatever. And they just, like we do in a meeting, I just got scooped up. Lots of emails welcoming me to Cocaine Anonymous. And there was a woman in Holland who replied back, and she said to me, do you have a copy of the big book? And I said, no, I didn't know what one was. And she said, if you feel comfortable, I'll post you a big book, which she did, which I've still got here, same one. And she popped that in the post, and that arrived a few days later. Didn't know what I was supposed to do with that. The women online said that I needed to get a sponsor. And they sent me a list, an email list of women willing to be an online sponsor. And there was one woman in Europe, all the rest of the women were in America. So I chose the woman in Europe because I figured we'd be on the same time frame. And I wrote to her and she responded. And I said, I think I need a sponsor. Will you sponsor me? And she wrote back and she said to me, was I willing to go to any lengths? And I wrote back and said, I guess so, yes. And she said, I want you to pray in the morning on your knees and ask for a clean and sober day, which I did. I don't think I got on my knees for a few years. I struggled with that, but that's another part of the story, you know. But I did pray. I started to pray straight away, asked for a clean and sober day. And I was to work through the book. She was going to take me through the steps online. And I was to work on them every day. 10 minutes a day was too little and 2 hours a day was too much. And in the evening, I was to, she got me into a step 11 process pretty quickly. In the evening, I was to email her, you know, what had gone well, what hadn't, you know, thoughts, feelings, whatever. And I was to attend an online meeting every day, which was essentially writing and reading an email, or the emails that came in the women's meeting every day. And I did that. You know, we talk about 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, I did 90 online meetings in 90 days, then another 90, and another 90, and you know, whatever, did that for about 5 years. And, you know, and Monica, my sponsor, started to take me through the work. And what she would do, she would email me chapters of the big book with questions. And so there'd be a couple of paragraphs and there'd be a question, and I was to relate my experience to what I'd just read. And she took me through the book in that way, you know, via email. You know, I did not have money to make international phone calls when I came in. I did not speak to Monica on the phone. I think I probably spoke to her on the phone 3 times in 6 months. That's it. It was all email. And she wrote, and I wrote to her every day, and she responded to me every day. And then if there were a couple of days, if I didn't write to her, she didn't email me back. And I worked out pretty quickly that I had to go to her for the program. If I didn't, if it had to come from me. And you know, she took me through the work, answering the questions, you know, literally straight out of this book. And I had a spiritual experience of the educational variety. And I, you know, went online every day and read the emails and hung out. And it's wonderful online because people are literally in their homes using, typing in help cocaine into their search engines. And they're finding us at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we're with the biggest worldwide meeting. Someone's always up. And it's wonderful because we were just constantly greeting people. You know, I'd be greeting people in America at 2 a.m. and they'd be greeting the Brits at 2 a.m., you know. And it was wonderful. We would direct people to meetings. And then there were a couple of people like me that were in the middle of nowhere, loners, on our own. You know, there was a woman in Grenada. She was a loner. We were the island girls. I was on Menorca. She was on the island of Grenada. There was a woman in Germany who was instrumental in starting Cocaine Anonymous Germany. She was on her own. And, you know, it was just epic, really. So I went through the work. I joined Hope, Faith and Courage, which is a mixed meeting of Cocaine Anonymous when I was about 3 months sober. And you know what, one day I'm having a little whinge up about the fact that I've got no addicts to talk to face to face. And they said to me, Lucy, you've got to start a meeting. So I applied to the service office in America for a starter pack, and which arrived, and it was beautiful. I'll never forget it when this pack arrived. And this big, beautiful white folder with a big CA logo on it, and it had all chips and literature in it and whatnot. But you know what, I'd never been to a meeting before, so I had no clue what to do with any of it. And so I just kind of, you know, parked it up, carried on working my program. And when I got to step four, I'd finished writing my step four, I think I was about 4 months sober, and Monica said to me, and again this blows me away more today than it did back then, and she said to me, I'm going to come to Menorca so I can sit down and listen to your fifth step. And she took 2 aeroplanes at her own expense from Holland into Menorca. And she arrived on the 5th of January, 2006. And Cocaine Anonymous Menorca opened on the 6th of January, 2006. And she and I sat down and she showed me how to have a meeting. And we spent 3 days, you know, with her listening to my step five. You know, just, it gives me goosebumps, you know, just thinking about it now. When I think about the any lengths that somebody else went to for my recovery. So she, you know, we did that part of the program and off she went. And Thursday night was the meeting of Cocaine Anonymous in Menorca. And do you know what? I went every Thursday and I put the books out and the literature out, and no one came. And no one came for about 6 to 9 months. No one showed up. And you know what? I always joke about the fact that I don't know what I was more afraid of, you know, no one coming or someone actually showing up, you know. And in the end, there was a man who found me through the English church, because obviously I've got, you know, Monica had got me out there, posters and carrying a message. And she was like, and I remember in the meeting, I'd come home in those sort of 6 to 9 months and I'd go, no one came, no one came. And they'd say, Lucy, you know, Alan in Florida would say to me, Lucy, give it 2 years. You know, if no one comes for 2 years, then you can close it, but you're in for 2 years. And I was like, all right, I'm in. You know what, and you know, it's weird when I think back, because I was flaky as anything all through my life. I've never stuck at anything, and I don't know why. It never occurred to me not to go on that bloody Thursday night. I always went, and eventually somebody did turn up, and his name was Alan, and he was a former Scottish Conservative MP with a big handlebar moustache, and he must have been about 10 or 12 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was me, and at the time I had very short bleached blonde hair and a big tattoo and cocaine addict. And he and I sat down and we would have a meeting. He'd come over on holiday a couple of times a year. And we do all the readings, we do something out of the big book. And Alan was my home group, you know, off and on for about 5 years. And I don't know what I would have done without him, you know, and I got so much identification. It was amazing. And the meeting of Menorca became such a wonderful meeting. People would come over from the UK, because I come over to conventions, I come over to CA UK every year in Brighton, and I would just race up and down the corridors of that hotel, you know, meeting people, and I get plugged in, and you know, it was epic. And people started coming over on holiday, and my telephone number was the helpline for Menorca, which probably rang about eight times in 5 years, but you know, while I was there. And you know, people would ring me up and go, it'd be like January, and they'd be like, I'm booking my holiday for July, I want to make sure there's a meeting there. And I'd be like, yes, someone's coming in July, you know, and it would just keep me going. And we had meetings on boats and beaches, and oh, it was just epic. It was brilliant. Cocaine Anonymous rocked, it really did. And you know what, Monica was one savvy woman, because you know, without her instilling that commitment to service, I probably wouldn't be here now. You know, she didn't want to know if I emailed about, you know, whatever going on in my life, she would come back and go, have you put that poster up in that doctor's surgery, what have you done, you know. And I think she just knew that you know, I had to get entrenched in service, which is what I've always done, pretty much off and on. You know, I get, you know, God willing, I get to celebrate 15 years sober this year. No fronts, I'm 14 years sober. You know, and what have I been doing for the last 14 years? You know, other than service to Cocaine Anonymous, I've stolen this from another fellowship. I spent a lot of time thinking that social acceptability equaled recovery, and it doesn't. I spent a lot of years trying to present an image to the outside world. And when I first came in, you know, I got really busy with CA and starting the meeting, and I got a job and a boyfriend, and I passed my driving test, and I got a car, and I bought a house, and you know, and then I lost my job, split up with my boyfriend, house got repossessed in the recession in Spain, and you know, the car went back, and it was, you know, and it's like, fuck, you know, this kind of incomprehensible demoralization again. And I spent a lot of years trying to nail jelly to a wall in my recovery. You know, if only it would stick, it would be all right. You know, if only the boyfriend or the job or the, you know, and what I realized, you know, it's such a cliche, all the cliches are true, it is an inside job. But I spent a lot of years, you know, yes, healing the past, but in the present, I was still trying to make, you know, the outside look pretty, meanwhile not knowing what the hell to do, what was going on inside. And I moved back to England when I was 5 years clean, and I'm bloody glad I did. It was because of the recession, the crisis, financial crisis that really hit Spain around that time, and I couldn't find work, or it was really badly paid work. So I decided to come back to England to retrain in tourism, funnily enough. So I came back to England, and it was around that time that my, you know, Father's Day today, I have two fathers, both of them are dead now, but my stepfather died around about that time. And it just catapulted me into, you know, into a different level of my recovery. And, you know, I'm so grateful that I was in England, because do you know what, that online experience, you know, it can make for a semi-interesting story, but I tell you what, there's nothing, and this is wonderful, Zoom is awesome, but there's nothing like one addict looking you in the eyes. You know, it's nothing like somebody knowing. And I think I really hit a crisis in my recovery when my father died, and I had some good people around me, and they made some strong suggestions. And those suggestions for me were, you know, to double down in my program, which I did do. I also got some outside help, which I really needed. And I also went to another fellowship, you know, because how a lot of my stuff manifests itself is that I am one of those people that has gone from one relationship to another, you know, painfully and humiliatingly, one relationship to another, hoping that that's where I was going to find the solution. And like I said, this sort of all came to a head when I was about 6-7 years sober. And I'm so grateful for that help, you know. I also went back to school and I retrained. I've grown up here in Cocaine Anonymous, basically. You know, I spent a lot of years wandering around, not really having any consequences when I was using. And I didn't really know how to take care of myself. And I've learned how to do that here. So those years from sort of 7 onwards were really important years in my recovery. You know, I just went deeper. You know, that's what I did. Deeper into outside help, deeper into another fellowship, deeper into my own. And, you know, it was a bloody making of me. It really was. And I'm so grateful for it. It's where I really began to love the woman that you see before you. You know, and not in that cliched way, just a real kind of a knowing and a grounding. When I always joke about this, when I was heading towards 10 years sober, I started taking credit for it. I kind of, you know, edged God out, that old chestnut, and suddenly I was 10 years sober and it was jazz hands and wasn't I brilliant? And I thought that I would start turning up at meetings and I was going to get taken off into a side room, you know, and I'd go into a side room where everyone that's in double digits of sobriety, we'd all be in there, you know, cups and saucers, being epic, you know, and you know, it'd all be amazing. And I joke, what I got at 10 years sober was an anxiety disorder and a tea commitment, you know, and thank God. And I realized that, you know, and it was a thing, you know, I suffered with severe anxiety for about 2 years. And by the grace of God, what it did for me was it just pushed me, it pushed me closer into the arms of my higher power, actually. And I really had to get closer to God. And it sounds so wanky and such a cliche when I say it out loud, but you know, it was just kind of me and God. And I was having night terrors and I was, you know, too scared to go on motorways, didn't like going on trains, didn't want to go in tunnels, you know, it was all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I started working with a new sponsor around that time who's here in the meeting this evening. And, you know, she just walked me through it really gently. And it was like a layer of me needed to come off. It was like a cracking of my armor. And like I said, you know, I walked into my local meeting and I put my hands up and got a tea commitment. And I was back to that wax on, wax off, wax on, wax off in my recovery, going to work, going to meetings, going home, going to work, going to meetings, going home. And I did that for about 2 years. And I had spent a lot of time wearing jackboots in my recovery, kicking my way through everything. And that had to come off. And it did. And it was just, you know, it was beautiful, absolutely terrifying, but beautiful. And I can't even describe the experience. And it was all about the relationship with myself. And it had been a long time coming. You know, I spent a lot of years simultaneously running away from and to that point in my life. It just had to be me and God. And, you know, I got to do that. I just thinking about, you know, where we are at today and it being Father's Day. And just thinking about that time in the last few years, my biological father, he died on Christmas Eve last year, and we've pretty much been estranged since I was 5 years old. And we've made attempts in recovery. You know, I made amends when I first came in, and he and I have made attempts to have a relationship over the years, and it's never really worked out. Too much pain, too much resentment. And I did a step four in, I don't know, a couple of years ago, and I'd had a resentment of my stepmother since I was about five, because she was violent to me and when I was a child. And took me 12 years, I was 12 years sober, for that resentment to finally go. And I've put that woman through a lot of step fours. I've prayed for her a lot, and I thought she was a see you next Tuesday for a lot of years as well. And so when I was 12 years sober, this resentment finally shifted. And what I realized is that I'd grown to a point in my own life, potentially through having this period of anxiety, to soften my heart in so many areas. And I woke up to the fact that this woman must have been really unwell to her, a child. And my resentment of her just melted away. And it coincided with me popping around to see my dad. And I'd see my dad once every few years. And when I went to his house that day, I realized that he was really ill. And he'd been just diagnosed with Parkinson's dementia. And it gives me goosebumps, I think about it, it was October, I think it was 2017. And I remember coming away from his house and sobbing in the car, because I thought to myself, I'm never going to have the relationship that I want with him. And it was just unbelievable, because as a result of my heart softening to her, I was able to be of service to him in the last 2 years of his life. Obviously, I didn't realize it was the last 2 years of his life. I was able to call her up with love in my heart and say, are you okay, Judy? Is there anything I can do for you? How can I support you? And what I was able to do was I stopped demanding and expecting something from him. I don't know whether I wanted him to tell her or stand up for me. I don't know what it was I wanted, but the whole thing just unclicked. And I was able to go up there as often as I could, up to Suffolk, and take him out for lunch. And, you know, I'm talking about a man who was progressing with Parkinson's dementia. And sometimes I'd have to put his belt on his trousers, because obviously the movement of Parkinson's makes him lose a lot of weight. So I'd have to help him with his trousers and take this man shuffling out for lunch. And he usually forgot his wallet and had to pay for lunch. But I was able to be there for the last 2 years, and it was all, you know, my God is great. And it all came from shifting the resentment of Judy. And I went up there and had lunch with him, the last lucid lunch. And then obviously I went to the hospital and was at his bedside when he died, you know, the day before he died. You know, I went up and sat by his bed, and you know, that's what I've been given here in Cocaine Anonymous, you know, and this program is such a miracle, you know, just such a miracle. Who knew, you know? And that's it, you know, you just got to keep going. Keep putting Judy through the fucking step four for 12 years. And eventually it went, you know, but it went when it was supposed to go. And you know what? I think that's why I stick around here. Because when I first got here, I was told that there was more. And that is my experience. There is so much more on offer here. And today, you know, where am I at today? Today, I am surrounded and held by love. And that's from my friends, from my fellows, from my higher power, from me. You know, I train professionally. I don't have to wing it at work. I've got a job that I'm trained to do that I love. I have a beautiful new home. I just moved house yesterday. I live by the seaside. And you know what? I'm just another bozo on the bus, you know. Cocaine Anonymous is my home. It's where I grew up. And it's where I shall continue to stay. And I'm going to leave that there. Thanks, everyone. Thanks so much for letting me share.
Wow, thank you, Lucy.
That was amazing. Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks, babe.
That was amazing. Thank you so much. Yeah, I wasn't lying when I said a spiritual slap around the face. That was your humility just shines through. And I think as like one of the original online meetingers, like I can sometimes get caught up in being like, oh, I've not gone to another Zoom meeting. You just show me, you know, like the, you know, the willingness you had to go through email forums, you know, like that blows my mind. And the fact that you stuck around, and the fact that you stuck at that meeting, you know, you stuck around at that meeting and you were there to carry that message when someone was ready. And honestly, just bursting with gratitude for your share today, because it shows me that, you know, that you know, the heart does soften. Somebody put that in the comments. And yeah, look, I mean, Lucy, we don't really do sharing back at these events. We like to open the meeting up for questions. So guys, because of that, just to avoid sort of things just go running over, because we like to sort of run these on time. If anyone has got any questions, if you want to raise your virtual hand and I can bring you in to ask Lucy a question, then please go ahead now. I'll kick it off, Lucy, just while we wait for people. How did you find sponsorship in those times? Because, you know, obviously, like, our primary purpose is to carry that message, you know, and obviously you were sort of cut off relatively. I know you sort of shared a little bit about how you sort of went about that, and, you know, you were there for the next person that needed that online stuff. But how did you find carrying that message? Do you continue through the online forums? Like, how did you find that in early days?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Ashley. And I guess there were local people. There were a few people on Menorca that reached out for help. And I did sponsor people over the years. In fact, my first sponsee was a man, because I was literally the only person on the island to do that. And I consulted with people, you know, my people, my sponsor, and they said, you know, you've got to do it. And I also did service in the sense of, you know, I used to post a reading online. I posted reaching out every Thursday. So I just did the service that I could do. And I guess I held myself in willingness to carry the message whenever I could. And then, of course, you know, my experiences that I sponsor online, I've sponsored lots of women online over the years. Had a sponsee in Chicago for many years. So yeah, just, you know, in the way that I was sponsored, I continue to sponsor and just held myself in readiness to do whatever service I could to carry the message.
Amazing. I've got an uncle who's got a house in Menorca, and I used to think it was so dull when I went over there, because I was like, oh, I was only a kid and I wanted to do loads of cool things. You've given me a whole new perspective on Menorca. I've fallen back in love with it, thanks to you. We've got AB. Unmute yourself and you can come in and ask a question, buddy.
Yeah, my name's Anthony and I'm an addict. Yeah, thanks for your share. It's really good to hear you, Lucy. Thanks everybody that's service on this meeting. Yeah, so you kind of spoke about, you know, your stepmom and the forgiveness process, and it took 12 years to actually forgive and realise and to get your spiritual eyes and your heart opened up to realise that, you know, she was a sick woman and she might have had I've kind of come to realise that, you know, other people might have had a rough upbringing as well. When did you find that place of forgiveness? Was it the 12-year point, or could you get any glimpses of it before that?
I think it was quite literal. I'm just trying to see. If you've got your camera on, I don't know if I can see you. Just wanted to be able to respond to your face.
Yeah, can you see me?
Hold on a second. Yep. Where are you? Can you say something, then you'll come up.
Hello. AB, I think I'm at the top of the participants. You got me, love?
Yeah, right. Do you know what? If I'm honest, it was at that 12-year point. I'd love to say that it had come before then, and it really didn't. It was just at that point, you know, as a result of going through the work, for whatever reason, in that October in 2017, that's when I got the forgiveness, not a moment before.
Mm. Was that the period of time that you were kind of spending with God after, you know, being the trials, tribulations and temptations coming up, but you pushed closer into God through the program?
Yes, absolutely spot on. It was right at that time. I was really close to my higher power and me. I'd spent a lot of time just on my own, you know, with myself. You know, I'd been stripped back of a lot of the outside stuff and outside people, and, you know, trying to bury myself in relationships and stop working. So I was spending a lot of time on my own. So yeah, it was. It was a time when I just spent walking with God.
Yeah, so you understand. So there was no distractions. And amazing, amazing.
Thanks, they're excellent questions. Thank you, I hadn't thought of it in that way before. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andy. Guys, I can't see any of the hands up. If anyone just wants to unmute themselves and come in and ask Lucy a question, you're more than welcome to. Otherwise, I'll start picking people. Vicky, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for that amazing share. Absolutely blew my mind. My dad had Parkinson's and died 2 years ago. What is your kind of routine around meditation and prayer today? And how has it changed?
Well, I guess it's interesting because I didn't possess the ability to sit with myself probably until I was about 10, Vicky. You know, that I attempted to meditate but couldn't. But funny enough, this period of anxiety really got me in a place that I needed to be. And I think I also, where I was suffering so much with anxiety, you know, I spoke to my sponsor about it a lot, and I actually went off and I did one of those MBCT courses for life. I went and did a mindfulness course. That really helped. I do a lot of walking. I do a walking meditation. Funnily enough, I use Insight Timer and things like that. Today we're so blessed with so many apps, aren't we? Prayer. Again, it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but I pray all day long, all throughout the day. You know, funny enough, my sponsor and I, and there's a little group of us, my sister sponsees, we meet every couple of times a week, and we were talking about our whole lives becoming a prayer. And I think that's what I meant about, you know, I'm another bozo on the bus. I belong here in Cocaine Anonymous. You know, this is, and the whole lot's a prayer, really. But yeah, I mean, this morning, you know, when I do get out of bed on occasion, I get straight on my knees and pray. And that's I like to do that as an act of humility. But yeah, I had to put some effort into meditation. But yeah, hands up, it took me 5 years to get on my knees to pray. And it probably took me 10 years to develop a meditation routine. But I'm here to grow. So thanks for the question, Vicky.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy. Jamie, good to see you, buddy.
Lucy, what's the best bit of advice you've been given in recovery?
Well, I don't really like to give advice, to be quite frank, because it's always, you know, opinions are like arseholes, aren't they? Everyone's got one. I guess it's about, it's suggestions, isn't it? It's following suggestions, and I guess those suggestions are, you know, let's go back to the beginning, Jamie and Monica. Get on your knees and pray every morning, work the steps every day. 10 minutes a day is too little, 2 hours is too much. Say your prayers in the evening and have a little tally up of what went right and what didn't go right. You know, that's the best suggestion that I can give. But advice, yeah, it's always a tricky one, isn't it? Thanks for the question.